So am I still waiting, waiting a long time,
waiting for tonight. Oh.
Listen to review,
I've been waiting for the second Jacob for my whole career since I started wrestling in Japan 2 years before. It's like a dream come true, and tonight I'm going to show everybody in Japan and all the other wrestlers that I am one of the top junior heavyweights in Japan. First round, I face Hanzo Nakajima, and Hanzo, you are a very good wrestler, a very good flying wrestler, European style, Mexican style. But tonight, I'm going to show you that I'm just a little bit better, a little bit quicker, and a little bit stronger, and I'm going to advance to the second round to face you, Wild Pegasus. You better watch out, because you haven't heard of me before. I'm going to surprise you, and I'm going to surprise everybody else out there. Watch out for Lionheart, because in the second J-Cup, I'm going to come out on top.
Welcome to Review Away, everybody. It's John Pollock, and joined back in studio by perhaps way our most popular guest, W.H. Park.
Mm-hmm.
By percentage, there was not one negative comment when W.H. was on last time.
I'm very flattered.
Consistent. Everybody enjoyed that last one, because I didn't know how people would take to the Super J Cup, and a product that a lot of people, some are not familiar with, but it was, I think that's one of our most popular episodes we've done, Way.
Yeah, can you gauge that by, like, downloads or just reaction, probably?
We got a lot of downloads for it, so that's always good. And the feedback was all very positive. So
yes,
the fact that he's hitting us up for an appearance fee this time, I think it's warranted.
Sure.
This time.
We'll give you a portion of what we get, which is zero.
Wow. It's
WH is a worker, though.
More than I was expecting.
WH hit me up for an escrow account and everything for this. It's, you know, he's like an 80s indie worker.
Hmm.
Well, I used to be involved with the old law, so, you know, I'm kind of used to this. So.
That's true. So we thought we would move on this time and chat about the 95 J-Cup. But before we start, we're recording this on Friday, and obviously a huge story in the world of professional wrestling on this Friday with the passing of Randy Savage. And before I started, WHS, I wanted to get some of your thoughts on Randy Savage, who, when you look back at the history of characters in the World Wrestling Federation, he's right in that top tier of people that were instrumental to that company's success in the 80s.
Oh, for sure. I remember when I first saw Randy Savage in the WWF, I was like, I hate this guy. He was such a great heel. I was like, oh, I hate this guy. I want Tito Santana to kick his ass. I want Ricky Steamboat to beat the shit out of him. I even wanted Hulk Hogan to beat him up, and I hate Hulk Hogan, you know, because but he was such a great heel, great character, such a great worker. And
he was just such a different style for the WWF at that point when he came in 85. I mean, it was just, the WWF had their style, and he was such a contrast to it. And really, of course, it was that chemistry he had with guys like Tito, with Valentine, with Steamboat, that kind of gave you that kind of, really kind of defined that intercontinental title division where you could get some good work rate in the middle of a card.
I think he's also kind of one of those guys that was like, did what I would call kind of almost a hybrid style, like, because
mm-hmm.
he could do power wrestling, like, because he could match up with all the power guys up there, but he could also fly, he could also like do some technical wrestling, so he kind of combined all kinds of different styles into one package. Plus, he could cut amazing promos, and he had charisma coming out of his ears, and just the look. I mean, like, all those robes. I think one thing you can remember about him were all the robes. If you can say, like, oh, who had the best robes, you say Ric Flair, so and so, but you also put Randy Savage up there as well.
And one thing I was thinking about today is just the fact that this news, I mean, this is not just a wrestling story. I mean, there are people everywhere talking about this, like mm-hmm. whether it be actors or people that grew up on the Macho Man Randy Savage.
Yeah.
I mean, he was just this unbelievable character. And I think that's really something, like, I don't want to turn this into dwelling on a product or something, but I mean, I can't even fathom someone of this generation outside of, like, of a John Cena having that kind of impact. And you look at that 80s WWF scene, I mean, there was a bunch of them who were these just huge characters that people, even 25 years later, still remember these characters so well.
No, I think that has more to do, though, with just the popularity of the product at the time that these guys were on the top, rather than, you know, the characters themselves, I'd say.
Yeah, I don't know. I just, I see that those 80s characters, I mean, whether it be the NBC deal or, you know, the cartoon, they had such a mass appeal to so many people. I think even if you look at the late 90s and that attitude period, I mean, who are the characters you really recall out of that period outside of Austin, Rock?
Those are pretty big ones.
All right, but I mean, look at today, the Bushwhackers. You go to someone on the street, and I guarantee you right now, people have heard of the Bushwhackers if you were to walk down the street, or Brutus the Barber Beefcake. But if you ask who's the Godfather, I don't think you're going to have that same
maybe
thing.
Maybe not.
Maybe I'm not making my point.
No, perfectly. You are. You absolutely are.
Anyway, those are just some of my thoughts. But let's get into something completely different. From the Bushwhackers to the Super J-Cup. December of 1995, and WH, this one was one of the big noticeable differences from the first stage to the second was the absence of Michinoku Pro in this tournament. And what was kind of the reasoning behind this? Because this one was hosted not by New Japan, but by our favorite Wrestle and Romance, or Wrestle Association R.
Yeah, Tenryu's group. I'm not sure. Like, there is actually one person from M Pro in this, which is Grand Anyway. He's actually a Michinoku Pro wrestler. So I'm not sure why, like, Sasuke and Delphin weren't in this one. They might have been on tour. Mm-hmm. That's what I would think. They might have just been on tour and they couldn't make the dates or something like that.
Sasuke held them up.
Maybe he did. You got to remember also, like, if you look at the Michinoku Pro logo, it says Northeastern Wrestling. So they actually don't really focus on the Tokyo area. They only focus, like, the kind of the suburbs and the rural areas.
Right.
So they might have been on tour at the time. I'm not sure. That's just my theory about that.
The show starts off, and we have the caption, "Dreams come true again." These the translations are always a highlight.
They all want that gold jacket.
That gold jacket that everyone strives for. And then they go through the performers for this year's show. Once again, 14 men competing in this tournament, and like, the first 45 minutes of this show was dedicated to promos from all of these guys over and over. We had Jushin Thunder Liger, Masayoshi Motegi, we had Masaki Mochizuki, Grand Nanawa, Lionheart Chris Jericho, who cut the greatest promo ever. Thanks to people for cheering him, and loves every one of the Japanese fans.
He's wearing that swanky suit, too.
Yeah. His first suit he ever bought. We had Damien, Hanzo Nakajima, Gato, Funaki, a very different Funaki than what North American fans probably recall, Dos Caras, El Samurai, Chris Benoit, Shinjiro Otani, and Ultimo Dragon, who, of course, was representing WAR. And all the members are in the ring, and they do this opening montage and call it the Supreme Battle of the Junior Heavyweight Wrestlers. And then they show the gates open and the fans filing in. This was a hell of an entrance. And at this point, I'm ready to watch the first match. But then we go into another opening ceremony where the interview of the entrant wrestlers is what we went into. And this was where we got Jericho in the suit and tie. Then we get this ominous announcement from the loudspeaker of "Let's get started," with this big heavy echo. And then they call out all of the performers for a big photo opportunity. This was seriously like 45 minutes.
And it's all, I guess it's good for a DVD or a tape, you know. If you're paying for all this extra content, you're probably, you know, if you're a fan from across the ocean, you're probably thinking, wow, this is kind of cool.
I was screaming for subtitles.
Yeah, I was too.
Well, they did the photo ops at the beginning because, like, they have to get their coverage in the magazines, right?
Oh, yeah.
It's very important. Like, one of the things, like, you have to remember, like, they're, like, the way they get exposure is not just through television, like, but mainstream media, like newspapers, magazines, cover this stuff. So they have to say, okay, we gotta get the photos, we gotta get the magazines, we gotta get the newspapers. So we have to do all these.
It's unusual, though, that somebody would film this and broadcast the photo taking.
Well, it's making them look like stars.
It does, yeah. Yeah. It's all about presentation over there.
And then we go into our first match, finally. Damien, representing FMW, he was taking on Grand Nanawa. And there's this great shot of Damien before he's coming out. It was like this low-angle shot of him where he's underneath this hood. And then it kind of like goes up as you see his face. I thought it looked really cool. And there were balloons thrown for Nanawa as he comes out. And he was just pretty much all comedy here, playing to the crowd, dancing. And then Damien starts doing Hogan's routine. He's posing. And then Damian basically does this gimmick of yelling out a wrestler's name and then delivering a signature maneuver for them. He would yell Choshu and apply a sharpshooter. Tenryu with chops. Then he called for Jinsei Shinzaki and scales the top rope, basically doing the old school maneuver. And then we saw the first of many on this night of a suicide dive to the floor by Damian. And basically they oversold everything they took here. We saw a discus forearm as Damian calls for Misawa. And then he misses the Muta moonsault. And then there's a Hurricanrana delivered and Nanawa gets the win here. And the fans chant for Onita after the match. And Damian does a whole post-match deal where he spits alcohol out at the crowd and tosses the alcohol onto the fans.
Yeah, that was Onita's
gimmick. Onita's whole deal there. Yeah. So this was
awesome. It was when I think about the show, like, this match stands out more to me than some of the others because it was so different. It was just a very fun comedy match.
I thought there was a lot of contrasting personalities you had in this tournament. Like Dos Caras was like this mm-hmm. guy with all these crazy submissions in here, and you didn't just have, you know, it wasn't just going to be straight. I don't know if I want to say, like, straight work rate, but you know what I mean? You had, I thought, much more variety here right out of the get-go.
I think that a lot of that has to do with, like, the inclusion of a lot of the Lucha guys. And
mm-hmm. that has
a lot to do with Ultimo Dragon. I think he actually, I would imagine he actually booked it and got a lot of the participants in this.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Then we go over to our next tournament match. It's Masaki Mochizuki, who still competes now for Dragon Gate and does some of their U.S. shows, taking on Shinjiro Otani. And right now, WH, I want to get the definitive answer on the spelling of Otani's final name, his last name, and if the H is proper or incorrect.
My God,
this is driving me nuts.
No, it's incorrect.
It is incorrect.
You have to understand, Japanese people, when they translate in English, they spell phonetically.
Yeah.
But real, like, if you do a direct translation, it's Otani, but they think it sounds like oh, like O'Henry kind of thing, but it's, you know, it's OTA.
Is that why Dragon on this show in the opening graphics was spelled Dragon?
Yes,
that's exactly why.
Okay,
I could probably go over there and make a killing just like correcting all their spelling mistakes.
Yeah, that's maybe we'll do a whole podcast on grammar, pronunciation, and spelling.
No, that's going to be my life for the next year. So
that's true.
I won't be doing that.
Yeah. Mochizuki comes out in this like white karate outfit with a headband, and the crowd was super excited for this match. And they do this reluctant handshake that the crowd is oohing and aahing at. And Mochizuki's delivering these knees to the head to start, and they tease a knockout finish early onto Otani. And we see a trade with a slap, low leg kicks, and then an exchange ending with Otani hitting a spin kick. And it was pretty much here the pro wrestler taking on the shooter mm-hmm. in Mochizuki, and that's how it came across. I thought it was really cool. And we see a heel hook, and Mochizuki reaches the ropes, and Otani holds on until the four count. And then Mochizuki responds with a bridging German for a two count, and then a Fujiwara armbar by Otani. That was also broken up with a rope break. And then the finish comes when we see a springboard dropkick to the bad left leg of Mochizuki that he'd been working on, and he applies a leg lock, so the pro wrestler submits the shooter here.
That's right.
I love this match.
I thought it was great.
I totally forgot
that Mochizuki was in this, and then I was rewatching it recently. I was like, oh my God, it's Otani versus Mochizuki. Battle of two great, what I call dickhead wrestlers. You know, like guys who just go, like, by dickhead, I mean, like, they'll go in there and just beat the shit out of you, like, slap you really hard, just be complete dickhead to you. But this is like before he became, like, before Mochi became like a big dickhead, because he's still kind of a young guy
yeah.
in the business, and he doesn't reach dickhead, supreme dickhead levels to like 2000 onward.
Mm. His head hadn't hit puberty yet.
That's right.
His okay.
Get bigger.
Gotcha.
Anyway, next up, and after each one of these matches, more interviews. These guys did as much talking on this show as they did work.
Hmm.
We go to Sho Funaki, one of your favorites, Wei.
Oh, for sure.
Without a microphone. Preach. Taking on Ultimo Dragon, and Funaki is seen pacing backstage. And I guess he was kind of like, where was he in his career at this point, WH? Was he still kind of a relative newcomer here, like one of the young boys graduating up?
He wasn't even like in Michinoku Pro at this point. He hadn't even joined
Kaitai. He was in Battle Arts, wasn't he?
He was in Battle Arts at this point. So I think he probably like was making a name for himself in battle arts. Battle arts, for those who don't know, is more of a kind of a shoot-style promotion. Yeah. So he did a lot of – he's more like a shooter kind of gimmick as well. So this is before he becomes like – like the great work he becomes in like Michinoku Pro with part of Kaientai and stuff, but he's really good in this match as well.
Mm-hmm. Taking on Ultimo Dragon, and just before we go on here, Ultimo Dragon is a guy that I grew up always being a gigantic fan of, and recently I've been listening to a lot of Colt Cabana's podcasts, and he was talking with Chris Daniels, and they said, so what do you have coming up next? And he's like, well, I'm going to be going over to Japan to work with Ultimo, and Colt's like, oh, that's shitty. And I thought he was just sarcastically saying that, like, oh, you get to go in the ring with a great worker. And apparently Ultimo's got, like, this rep of being a real dick to a lot of guys. Hmm. And Cabana was talking about this story about how he went to shake his hand, and Ultimo, like, just put his hand out and, like, wouldn't actually touch him and was, like, looking in a different direction. And it's like a lot of the guys, they just not fans of Ultimo Dragon. Hmm. I'd never heard that rep attached to Ultimo Dragon before.
It's a lot of the reason why Toriyama and the guys in Toriyama split from him and then formed Dragon Gate. Yeah, they didn't want to deal with him anymore.
Wow. He doesn't shake nice.
I don't think he pays.
He doesn't
very well.
Look at you.
I don't think he pays very well either.
Oh.
So the match starts off Pescado to the floor by Funaki. Funaki's working on the left leg here throughout, going for submissions. They exchange holds, counters. Funaki was the aggressor here, attacking the leg, and there was a long spot on the mat with both fighting for kind of the dominant position. Dragon hit one of the ugliest Hurricanranas I've ever seen here, mm-hmm. and then he dives off the second rope with a quebrada, but then Funaki is right back to the leg and basically gives Dragon a hope spot here, and then a fisherman buster suplex. And then we see a top rope Hurricanrana, a moonsault to the back onto Funaki, and then Dragon wins with the Mahastral Cradle, which would play into future matches on this card. And basically, it was like Dragon, it was like sell, 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 and then they rushed into this big finishing sequence of moves, and Dragon got the win with the Cradle.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So
I mean, Funaki was working on the leg, but I think a lot of times, and especially with like the SI moonsault and everything, they just completely forgot all that work.
It was like the middle of this match was gone. They just kind of rushed to this big, big finish spot.
Well, I have comments about Ultimo. We'll get to in one of his later matches.
Okay, you saved that. You probably brushed off WH at one point, too.
That's right.
I still always, when I look at some of these Japanese cards, I see like Liger or Ultimo Dragon, and I think to myself, I've seen these guys live at St. John's Hall.
Mm-hmm.
It's just so crazy.
I saw them buying a chocolate bar from the concession stand there.
I remember another one where when you and I went to the ROH show, that the match of the year one with Blood Generation and Doofixer, mm-hmm. and I'm going to the washroom, and I can't even remember who it was, comes in, he's just like pissing next to me. I'm like, man, I think it was, to be honest. I'm trying to remember who it was, but it was like, man, I just watched you have a match of the year candidate, and here you are pissing with the fans.
Yeah.
Another guy who needs to listen to Violent J, How to Be a Star. Have you heard that interview Alvarez has done yet, the Violent J one?
I've listened to half of it. I didn't finish it.
Oh, once you get to the part about how to present yourself, because I know you think like me in the same way of presenting yourself like you're a star, and some people just think it's crazy talk, but
hey, you gotta take
I think
a
there's
league.
A lot to be learned
take
from.
Take a league, you know?
There's only one working
piss in
walk?
The back. You know what, though? Chicago Ridge, if you've seen Cabana's documentary, that's the one that has that big gym in the back of it. So don't tell me that the public washroom was the only
it's
option.
Probably
here.
Full.
Ooh, wait in line. Wait in line or get in line, because you're going to be a member of the
Hey, he's Japanese. They're lucky he didn't piss on the wall. That's not...
You're kidding? Some fan would freaking touch it with his hand.
Probably. I got a souvenir.
It's like those fans who grabbed Aguayo's blood when he was all... Remember when Worlds Collide and he was bleeding and the fans are reaching out to
gross.
Touch him?
I don't remember.
Yeah. My goodness. We're going off on tangents here. Next up, We had Masayoshi Motegi, I hate pronouncing that name, taking on Gato, who was back here. These, the two worst dressed workers of this entire tournament.
No, you see, like, Motegi took off his thing. He was like, yo, look, I'm wearing a black pajama top just like you, but it's black. So F you. That was his, like, psychological warfare on Gato there.
I guess they were hoping to have the sleeper match of the night here.
I see what you did
gotcha.
There.
There you go. You can groan. Fast pace to start this match. It ends with a suicide dive to Gato on the floor, and then beats him with a title belt. No honor here from Motegi. And then he smashes the left arm of Gato into the post and then continues to work on the arm, including an arm bar applied. And actually, here, if you're watching this, he actually was in position where he could have delivered an omoplata here to Gato. But this was before omoplata, I think, was even discovered at this point in 1995. Gato then gets top position and out, and then he starts channeling Dusty Rhodes with elbows here. Modigay regains the heat here with a punch to the arm. This was awesome. Gato just started selling this. He just punched him right in the arm. And then Gato selling here. I thought his facials were great. We see a tilt-a-whirl head scissors by Modigay and then a pescado to the floor on Gato. Modigay's shirt comes off, and then he starts posing to get heat. This guy was like the most unbelievable heel on this show. I enjoyed him quite a lot. Gato gets a brief comeback. He misses a top rope headbutt and takes three consecutive Germans by Modigay, who got zero height on these Germans but delivered them nonetheless. And the last one was a bridge for a two count. And the finish comes with a Modigay going for a diving headbutt. And again, Gato counters with a Hurricanrana with a powerbomb. Sorry, Gato counters a Hurricanrana and delivers a powerbomb and then applies the grounded double chicken wing for the submission victory.
Well, that's a Tenryu's move, the WAR special.
Yes.
Oh. That's right.
Maybe this is where Matt Hardy was inspired by the ice pick, which is almost like a reverse of this from the front. So Gato gets the win here.
Yeah, pretty okay. Pretty standard.
I enjoyed Modigay a lot in this match.
Like, match.
Played a
you know what, what made this match even better? He's wearing Zubaz pants with that pajama top. If
they
only.
Can't give everything away, though, in one match. Come on.
I know.
And then we go, we continue with the opening round, and we've got El Samurai taking on Dos Caras, who, for those unfamiliar, the brother of maybe the biggest dick in wrestling amongst people,
Mil Máscaras,
and the father of Alberto Del Rio. And Caras was 44 years old at the time here, representing EMLL, now CMLL. And early on, I thought this match was going to completely depend on Samurai and his selling, and because I looked at Dos Caras and I saw a 44-year-old man. I'm like, what are we going to see here from this guy? I quickly appreciated this guy later on. We see a real funky submission to Samurai, and that was pretty much Caras was just bringing out all these weird submissions, and it was really cool by like match number two for him. We saw a version of the Koji Clutch with a hammerlock applied by Caras. Samurai reached the ropes, then a surfboard by Caras. Samurai goes to the floor. Caras hits a suicide dive. We had seen like five suicide dives by like match number five here.
Oh, it's like a punch.
It became a punch by the second round. We see a reverse twisting Nelson onto Caras' back as he applied a submission. Then a really shitty pile driver by Samurai for the two here. And then Caras applies this weird crucifix-style rolling pin for another two count. Samurai struggles for a power bomb, finally got him up, and just dropped him. And then Samurai, he goes for a top rope Hurricanrana as the ref is yelling uno, dos for the count. Then misses a diving headbutt to Caras, and Caras hits a high cross from the top for the win. And his high cross looked much better than Christina Crawford on Tough Enough this past week. Did note that. So, Dos Caras advancing to the second round here. What were your thoughts on his inclusion in this tournament?
I thought it was really interesting. It's like, because you didn't have anyone like him in the 94 tournament.
Mm-hmm.
When I first heard of it, because I had heard his name before, when I first saw this tournament, I was like, what's this old dude?
That was my impression at the start of this.
And he doesn't even look like a junior heavyweight.
No, not at all. He looks like a 45-year-old man.
Did he bribe someone to get in here? Like, and then I didn't watch his performances, and not only this match, but other matches that he has, and I'm like, holy shit, he's pretty good.
They pop for his submissions, and
Well, he's also, like, I think another reason why probably he was included is because he is a legend in Japan.
Cause yeah.
He would go over with his brother, Mil Máscaras, and I think they worked for Baba in All Japan. So the Japanese fans know who he is.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, sure. I mean, his name had a huge part of this. Then Caras cuts a promo backstage. Don't know what he says, but I just wrote here, maybe he was saying it was his destiny to win this tournament tonight. Mm. Then we go to Hanzo Nakajima and a very young Lionheart Chris Jericho, who, thank God, the ring was mic'd so well, because Chris Jericho might as well have just done commentary for this match.
He must.
This was the highlight. This was like Jericho. It's like, okay, I've worked Smokey, and this is my chance to bust out on the Japanese scene, and I'm going to play the biggest babyface imaginable here. And Nakajima comes out in a mask and then removes it in the ring and reveals a black and pink spandex outfit.
Tremendous.
And does a headstand onto the top rope for the intro. This guy was just nuts. Hanzo Nakajima.
He's actually also one of the other representatives from Michinoku Pro. He's a Michinoku Pro guy.
Oh, okay. Excellent.
Okay. Another Power Ranger from Michinoku Pro.
That's right.
They start by, instead of shaking hands, Jericho bumps his chest into Nakajima and then gives him the middle finger. And the crowd oohs at this. Jericho with the middle finger. Then we see a delayed vertical suplex by Jericho. Just yell, oh yeah, baby! And then does his standing pin yelling, Nakajima! This guy, I don't know if he was trying to get over as a babyface or a heel, but
I wouldn't say babyface.
Yeah, more so the heel here. But his promo at the beginning was so,
that's true,
like, babyface to the 1,000,000th degree. There's a spin kick and then a two count for Jericho. He's then yelling, come on, man, let's go. There's low leg kicks and then a spin kick that sends Jericho over the top. There's a baseball slide to Jericho and then, you guessed it, a suicide dive by Nakajima. Jericho stops Nakajima on the top rope with a slap and then climbs to the top, hits a drop kick, sending both down and then off of the ropes to the floor. And he gets the crowd to start cheering Hanzo. And there's a drop toehold by Hanzo, and he goes for the Gato clutch, which actually might have been applied as badly as Kelly Kelly's on Monday. And then there's a fisherman buster suplex. He yells, are you ready? Hits the lion salt for the win, and Jericho is advancing here. So the fun Canadian moves on to the second round of the tournament. What did you think of Jericho in this match?
It's another Chris Jericho match. I thought it was pretty cool seeing him try to communicate with the Japanese audience. Like, I have to wonder, does he carefully choose his words to make sure that they're easily understood by the audience?
Maybe. I thought it was okay match. I think it was great. I think they probably know who's going. Like, they all know who they're going to be doing later on. So I think he was saving himself for later.
Jericho celebrates backstage and says, tonight will be the night of the lion, and he looks forward to Wild Pegasus. And then we're heading over to the quarterfinals now, and we've got Grand Nanawa taking on Jushin Thunder Liger. Liger and Benoit have buys to the second round. And early on, for what reason? Benoit won last year.
Yeah, so he gets automatically, I think.
Liger's Liger. Liger booking this tournament, or was this like Ultimo booking it? Or?
I would imagine it was a joint effort. I imagine Ultimo promoted it and booked most of it, but I'm sure Liger said, okay, this is who's going to the semifinals. Well, you want that guy to go? No, we're going to go with this guy.
And here's who's going to win the tournament.
Yeah.
Nanawa hits a drop kick to Liger on the top rope to start during his entrance. The temerity of this fucker to Nanawa here.
With a giant lobster claws on his hands.
That's a gimmick. He's a crab.
I know. Think that this man would go as far as to have these prosthetic lobster claws made for his entrance. It was great.
Oh, I thought you were upset about that. I was going to what's wrong with you?
No,
it's awesome.
That's part of this guy. Awesome. He follows that cheap shot up with a Hurricane Rana and then a high cross off the top to the floor. Crowd was really hot at this. They were just couldn't believe the way Liger was being treated by this fucker. And then he hits an Otani-style drop kick to the back of Liger's head, then delivers a powerbomb for a two-count. Nanawa then dances across the second rope. Liger rolls over. Nanawa just continues going across the ropes, eventually misses Liger on the floor. Liger then blocks a Hurricane Rana, and then he mocks the Nanawa strut, and then hits a released German to Nanawa. There's a surfboard into a dragon sleeper by Liger, and then Nanawa counters it into his own version. We see a forward roll off the apron to the floor onto Liger. And then Liger makes his comeback. He's on top, but Nanawa gets up, takes a palm thrust, and then a top rope elbow for a two count. Then there's a Hurricane Rana reversal of a power bomb as Nanawa gets a near fall, and then Liger responds with a kick, and then the Liger suplex or the Fisherman Buster suplex and gets the win. So Liger disposes of Grand Nanawa in a probably, if you were laying down money, this was probably the safest bet of the tournament. Liger goes over Nanawa.
The thing about this match was, when I first watched, I'm like, holy shit, this, the crowd's hot. Like, they think at some points he's going to beat Liger. Yeah. And that's a credit to Liger.
For sure. They gave Nanawa a ton of heat at the beginning of the match. I liked it.
And it's another example of, Liger just being a generous man and saying, I'm going to make this kid look good.
Oh, he was extremely generous on the show, I think you could say.
Probably the best match of Nanawa's career. Probably of his career, I think.
This could have been. Wild Pegasus up next against Lionheart. Benoit had His mullet just screamed 1995 at this point. There's a nose-to-nose stare down, and then Jericho tells him, "Come on, motherfucker." And there's a big slap fest here between these two Canadians. And Jericho's getting in all his catchphrases of "Let's go, baby. Yeah, baby." And there was this really like gritty back and forth positioning by both. Benoit actually applies the what would later become the lion tamer onto Chris Jericho at this point. I don't even know if Jericho's using this at this point.
No, this really is early on. He eventually steals this move. But yeah. Then I think this is actually a move that wasn't invented by Benoit. I think it was invented by maybe Dynamite Kid.
Yeah.
Like, I think I've seen him use it in pictures and like on Tenryu in All Japan in the 80s and stuff.
Jericho misses a second rope moonsault out of the corner. Then we see a springboard dropkick off the top, which sends Benoit to the floor. Jericho leaps off the second turnbuckle with a moonsault to Benoit on the floor. Benoit comes back with his patented powerbomb for a two count. Benoit misses a diving headbutt. This allows Jericho to get a two count. Then Jericho goes to the floor and takes a suicide dive from Benoit. Jericho gets back at the count of 17. And then there's a bridging underhook German by Jericho that he nearly loses Benoit upon landing this. Then goes for the quebrada, lands on his feet. There's a hurricanrana for a two count on Benoit. Crowd was really into this match by the end. And Jericho goes for another quebrada, lands it onto the back of Benoit, and then applies the Gato clutch roll for a two count. Benoit is then seated on the top rope. Jericho climbs up, and Benoit counters and delivers a second rope tombstone pile driver.
He tries to, kind of messed up.
Yeah, it was a little almost lost here, but that was the intention here.
It looks more like a power slam.
Yeah.
This is the match that actually made me a fan of Chris Jericho.
Oh, is that
right?
I thought he was just like so bland in WCW. I was like, this guy's boring. But I saw this match, and I was like, oh, that's Chris Jericho in WCW. Oh, he's actually pretty good.
Was this the first time these two worked against each other?
I think so, yeah.
Because Jericho had just done at this point, you know, like your Canadian Indies and Smoky Mountain, and other than that,
he did a tour of FMW. Ooh, hated
FMW
that. And then he got into War, and he'd been...
War was after this for him, right? Or was it...
No, I think this is...
He had already been doing War here?
He was
representing War here.
Yeah, he's already doing War.
But yeah, you can really tell the difference in the characters here, and I think really, really cool to have pit these two in the bracket, because like Jericho and Benoit, despite coming from the same place, they both play such different characters. Here you have, you know, Benoit, who's a super disciplined guy, and this long-haired partier in Jericho, who's almost like a younger, bratty sibling to Chris Benoit. So I thought it worked well.
Up next, we've got Shinjiro Otani and Ultimo Dragon. This looked very, very promising. They do the whole respect deal at the start as Otani welcomes Dragon into the ring. Then Otani moves out of the way for a Dragon Pescado early on, and then drop kicks him off the apron. Otani continues to work over the leg of Dragon. He attempts a heel hook. Basically, this turns into a grappling bout at one point, with both trying to get position on the other guy. Then Dragon no-sells this jumping pile driver from Otani, and they go back and forth, and each just continue to no-sell the other guy's tombstone pile driver here. I did not understand this because of the finish of the last match, and later in other matches, I mean, the tombstone was utilized as, you know, to kind of build it. I did not understand this.
I didn't either.
To me, this is like kind of epitomizes like my feelings about Ultimo Dragon, because like before, when I first saw him, I thought, oh, he's a great worker, he's amazing. Now in hindsight, I can look back at his old matches and I think, oh man, he's kind of overrated actually, because like Otani does a lot of legwork on him,
yeah,
no sells it, because I think really ultimately, no pun intended, is kind of one of those flippy dude guys get all the shit in.
Mm-hmm.
Oh wait, I didn't do the quebrada yet. Oh, screw this selling of the leg, I'm gonna do it. Quebrada. Oh, I gotta get my hurricane in. I gotta get this in. He's gotta get all the shit in every match he does.
Yeah, like this to me, it was like this spot, it added nothing to this match, and it only like prostituted the move when it was going to be used later on. Like,
oh, it was just used in the match before.
I know, it was used before, and then it was going to be used later. Like, mm-hmm. you're hurting the heat for future matches on this card. It was just a nothing spot for...
And it wasn't even like the All Japan type of no-sell, where like the guys would take a finish and then get right back up and deliver something else, and then sell. Like, these guys would just completely no-sell it for the rest of the match.
Yep. Then we saw springboard reverse cross by Otani into a dragon drop kick. Then Dragon at one point, he applied the Mahastral cradle, and Otani kicked out to a big pop. So maybe Dragon could have taken some notes here. It's like, all right, we use this as the finish in the first round, and then it can build for heat later. Or we can do the opposite. Then there's the springboard drop kick to the back of Dragon's head. Dragon hits what TNA fans would know as like the spiral tap off the top rope, and this misses Otani, and then...
he overshot. He didn't mean to miss. This was supposed to be the finish.
Yeah, he totally misses this, and then Otani uses the Mahastral crate.
Dragon to cover for it does the Mahastral.
Oh, sorry,
they improvise the finish. There.
It's Dragon who hits the Mahastral cradle, gets the win, and then after the match, they slap each other and shake hands, and Otani is furious as he heads backstage and is just steaming here as the camera follows him.
Hmm.
Otani's great in this match. His facial expressions, amazing.
I love Otani, and watching him on this show, I thought he was fantastic. Next up, we have Gato and Dos Caras. Which on paper, hard to know what to expect from this match. Caras works over the left arm of Gato, and Caras then rolls through on his shoulders with like this victory roll into a leg lock, and then continues with leg submissions that Gato is just selling tremendously. Gato is then, I didn't know how to describe this, he was like in a downward dog position for you yoga freaks out there, with his arms stretched and Caras also having his hooks in on Gato. You have to see this to understand it, because I can't describe it. Gato then gets the heat with a low drop kick, and he tries to unmask Caras, and he's undoing the back of his mask, and we actually get to see his chin here as the fans are going nuts. Mm-hmm. The ref is attacking Gato, like, how dare you? And
the ref does a terrible job, by the way. The ref's just like counting to five repeatedly, and he's just like, stop it. And this goes on for like 2 minutes.
John McCarthy, this guy was not.
No, he was not.
And Caras makes his big comeback, but then Gato, with the ref not looking, hits a low blow and finishes him with the Gato clutch. Total heel here, mm-hmm. getting the win. No honor here from Gato.
Which is kind of rare to see in the J-Cup, was it not? Complete
I guess
heel
so,
tactic.
But Gato's a big heel in war at this time with like his mentor, who you see in the ringside.
Yeah,
with him.
Who was that?
That's Samson Fuyuki.
Oh, okay.
He was like Kawada's tag team partner in early All Japan stuff.
Oh.
And then he left All Japan when Tenryu left, and then when they formed war, he came with him, and he mentored both Gato and Jado.
I see.
That's who else is like seconding them is his tag team partner there.
And then we go to the semifinals. We're down to four, everybody. And first up, it's Jushin Thunder Liger and Ultimo Dragon. Very slow start here with each exchanging holds and counters. This weird arm crucifix by Liger for a submission attempt. And then all of a sudden, a lucha match broke out here. They go back and forth. They do the fish out of water spot. And then Liger is working over the left knee of Dragon. Dragon hits this springboard elbow into the corner, and then Dragon's on offense with his own figure four to work over the leg of Liger. Dragon hits a dive off the apron to Liger on the floor, and then a forward roll off the top rope to the floor onto Liger, and then both make it back in after they tease a count out. Liger then hits a brainbuster, and they check to see if Dragon is conscious here, while Liger just ignores it and goes for the pin. He then hits a tombstone, and then a diving headbutt for a two count. Liger attempts a fisherman buster suplex off the top. That's countered. Dragon goes for the Mahistral cradle for a two count, then hits a quebrada on Liger, misses a moonsault off the top to Liger, and then Liger hits a sit-out powerbomb for a two count. Huge reaction for that spot. And then a cradle for a kick out. Dragon comes back. He attempts another Mahistral cradle, but Liger blocks it mid-move and hooks his leg and basically uses his body weight on top of Dragon to pin him. So Dragon's move fucked him in the end against Liger.
There you go. Well, yeah. You know, Liger's the guy who knows all the moves, right?
So. Yep.
I really like the finish. It was just, played on the success of the Mahistral from before, and it was very surprising. Interesting placement. What did you guys think of putting this match in the semifinals instead of the finals? I mean, this on paper, when you look at all the participants in this match in this show, this would have probably been the most anticipated matchup.
I agree with you. I think what the idea is like, if you look at the way the tournament goes forward. I think the idea was to make Ghetto the next Sasuke for this tournament.
Yeah.
It doesn't exactly work out that way, but
But the philosophy of it, I was a much bigger fan of what they did versus putting Liger and Dragon. Like, did Liger and Dragon need to be in the finals?
Sure.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Like, that was. I don't know. I like the idea of this tournament being taking the guy that no one expects to make to the finals. I think it makes for a more compelling kind of story for the entire event. But
and you gain more at the end from that.
I think so. Yeah. And then we go to our other semifinal match, and I think this adds to my point. We had Gato against Wild Pegasus, and this might as well, for fans that were there live in the building, this might as well have been Steve Austin against Barry Horowitz and the way they viewed this. I mean, it was like this, the underachiever in Gato, he's made it all the way here to the Final Four, you know, a respectable showing for this guy, and now he's going to get destroyed by the guy who won the whole tournament last year, and it sets up Liger and Wild Pegasus. That's the logical assumption I'm sure everyone made watching this for the first time. And Benoit just destroys Gato from the start, like a high back suplex, superplex off the top. And then Gato stops Benoit with a knee into the corner, hits a Hurricane Rana, and then the 400th suicide dive of the evening to the floor. There's a set of bridging Germans by Benoit when they get back into the ring. Then the tombstone is reversed by Gato, and he drops Benoit, but more so on his back rather than a tombstone on the head. Benoit gets his knees up to avoid a splash off the top rope, and then takes Gato's head off with a lariat. And the crowd seems upset here at the kickout by Gato, that he's still alive. And then Benoit, he's annoyed that the guy won't stay down. He misses a diving headbutt off the top. Gato makes a comeback with a brainbuster, and then he hits a diving headbutt and gets the stunning win. This was probably the biggest upset on the entire show.
I think so.
Just genuine shock, and Benoit conveys that shock as he goes backstage, and it's like this guy just got upset here by Gato, the unlikely.
With his own move.
Yeah, with his own move, and that's the story here, that Benoit couldn't hit the diving headbutt and gets beat by it. I really enjoyed this booking. I mean, you can question if Gato was the right guy to do this with, but no one expected this guy to win, and I thought it was something fresh to at least, you know, putting the effort there to try and make a guy a star in one night was obviously the hope for with the booking of this tournament.
Yeah. Like I said, it didn't turn out that way, but I admired the intent of like, okay, we're gonna make one of our war guys a star of this tournament, you know.
I just didn't see what was there to gain with doing Benoit and Liger in the finals. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, if
it was a New Japan book show, sure, but this wasn't a New Japan book show; it was a war book show. So I can see like. I think one of the concessions was like, okay, so-and-so is going to win. We get it. But one of our guys has got to go all the way to the finals. He's going to win. He's going to at least be the guy to drop the fall in the finals to the eventual winner.
And I think I don't think anybody really has a problem with the booking. I think it's just, you know, like you mentioned, the fact that it was Gato receiving this push and not perhaps somebody else from
Nanawa.
Or who else
claws his way to the finals?
Who else was on the war roster at this time that you think would have been more deserving than someone like Gato?
Jericho, but he's not Japanese, so that wouldn't have made as much sense as using Gato.
So then it had to have been.
Yeah, Gato. It had to have been Gato. He's a talented guy. Mm, I think he showed a lot of promise because he had a lot of natural talent. He doesn't start to look like a star till later on, but. I think they had pinned a lot of hopes on him that he was going to be their Sasuke. Like, he's going to come out the star in this tournament.
It's kind of strange, though, because he is a heel, and in all these matches, he's playing the underdog.
Yeah, you're right. It was booked as the heel on the show. I mean, with the low blow finish, but you're still telling, the underdog story here of making it to the finals. Granted, I mean, it'd be very tough to be the babyface in the finals against Liger. You know what I mean? I think
you could still be the underdog, I'd say.
Well, whichever. And then we go the one non-tournament match on this show, and between Rey Mysterio and Psychosis. And beforehand, Rey Mysterio cuts his promo backstage. This was awesome. He's like, "Keep on cheering for Mexican wrestling. Yeah, war." He sounded like he had just like. I don't know.
How old was he at this point?
10. I don't know how old Ray was at this point.
I think it's like 18 or something like that.
Wow. He was pretty young in that.
He could be pretty young and still wrestle there because like Nakajima is like 16 when he started. So like they don't care like if you're 16, wrestling adults in Japan, like they don't care. So he could easily been under like 19 at this point still.
Psychosis and Ray, they had been working all over the place at this point. They had just had that big November to Remember match the prior month for ECW, so they were just tearing it up over there. And the seconds here for this match, we had Damien in the corner of Psychosis and then Ultimo with Ray. And we start things off with a tilt-a-whirl and then a tilt-a-whirl backbreaker by Ray. Ray turns a Psychosis powerbomb into an over-the-top rope Hurricane Rana, sending him to the floor, and then a dive off the turnbuckle to the floor. There was a handspring then onto the shoulders of Psychosis, turned into a Hurricane Rana by Ray. I mean, the speed of Mysterio was just incredible. Yeah. Like, he, to this day, works pretty graceful, but, I mean, if you look back at the mid-90s, I mean, he was just in a different league when it came to precision and just overall speed. Absolutely. And his size is also somewhat changed over the years.
Huh.
I don't know what you can count for that.
But you just said it. Like, I think a lot of Lucha might receive criticism for being sloppy, but like Rey Mysterio, everything he does is like so technical and so perfect. Everything is on, you know, not sloppy at all.
Then we see a dive off the turnbuckle to the floor. And as he's diving off the turnbuckle to the floor, he hits a Hurricane Rana upon landing. I mean, just crazy stuff they were doing here. Psychosis responds with a tope to the floor a few minutes later. Ray then hits a springboard drop kick to the back of Psychosis and then sends him to the floor. Then we see a top rope somersault dive to the floor. And then they get back into the ring, and Ray hit what fans would know now as the West Coast Pop with the springboard into the Hurricane Rana pin for a near fall. We see an Acai moonsault to the floor onto Ray. Then they go back into the ring. Psychosis is on offense, hits a top rope guillotine leg drop, and then the finish comes with a basically right in the middle of the ring. Ray hits just a standing Hurricane Rana for the win. This was a really, really solid match, and these two
50 Hurricane Ranas.
There were a lot of Hurricane Ranas.
Steiner must have been.
Wow. Oh, yeah. That was great. Did you hear that story? Last week, we were in Brantford, and I was interviewing Scott Steiner, and I asked him, man, how are you still doing Hurricane Ranas at this day and age? He's like, don't you ever fucking call it a Hurricane Rana. It's a Frankensteiner.
Mm-hmm. Oh, Scott Steiner.
Great. So anyway, really cool. Strong match. I mean, not too much you can criticize about this.
No. A great showcase match.
Yeah, I thought it was like a great breaker match for the tournament, between the semifinals and the finals, and I think it really opened a lot of fans in Japan, their eyes to like modern lucha. I mean, I think they were familiar with lucha, but they didn't see like what lucha at that point had progressed to with guys like Ray and Psychosis, and then they saw it within this match, like holy shit, these guys are doing like things we've never seen even in Japan. Like, because Ray was like a revolutionary.
Yeah.
Like with stuff he was doing, him and Psychosis.
What was the relationship like between AAA and some of the Japanese offices at the time? I mean, was there a lot of back and forth at the time, or was it pretty limited?
I think it was more the connection. These guys got on the show because of Ultimo, because he was known for going, like, doing a lot of lucha Mexico and doing a lot of stuff in Japan. But he was kind of like that connection. I think that's why he got this match on the show. If it's Liger booking it, I don't think you would have seen this match. But because War was booking it and Ultimo was booking it, he said, I want to showcase these two guys. I think they're really good.
Good point. Dragon then puts Ray on his shoulders following the match and did not drop him. Ray and Psychosis bow at each other. They do the respect angle. And it's just funny watching this because as they're doing this, Damien just kind of like saunters off. He's like, I'm going to have no part of this babyface bullshit. Live the gimmick. And then we go to the finals. Jushin Thunder Liger and Gato. Gato gets a very strong response here from the audience. Liger starts working on the left shoulder, including knees to the shoulder, and continues this for the next 5 minutes, including a chicken wing spot on the bad shoulder, an arm bar that he torques on, and then another chicken wing. Almost like he was working here as like somewhat the heel here, just brutally attacking the shoulder of Gato. And it ends up, well, Gato then breaks it with a low blow as the referee is distracted. So, nonetheless, we see a diving headbutt by Gato, the move he beat Benoit with in the last match, and then into the grounded double chicken wing, where he defeated Mortegay with in the first round. Liger struggles for the ropes, finally gets his foot under the bottom rope, and then we see two running Liger kicks to Gato in the corner as he gets back on offense. All the participants on the show are at ringside here, cheering for their respective peers. And then Liger comes off the top with a cross body and takes a drop kick upon landing from Gato. We see a release German by Liger, with Gato landing on his feet into a series of back and forth near falls. And then Gato attempts a superplex off the top, but Liger stops it with a palm thrust and then misses a drop kick off the top and takes a brainbuster. And then we see the Gato clutch applied. They get an awesome near fall spot. And then the people were actually believing here Gato had a chance to win, popping for this near fall. And Liger comes back. He hits the Fisherman Buster suplex off of the top rope, and he gets the gold jacket.
That's right. Great match.
Really good match. I mean, the fact that they could buy Gato as maybe he's going to pull it off here, I mean, that's a victory in and of itself. And this was, it was almost like he had two winners coming out of this tournament, because Gato just making it this far, I mean, was probably the highlight of his career up until this point, and really positioned him strongly, just hanging with these guys, beating Benoit in the tournament, last year's winner. I thought it did a lot for Gato, at least moving forward, to hopefully position him at that level. So. Mm-hmm. Overall, guys, afterwards, of course, the gold jacket was presented, and the other participants are in the ring with their J-Cup shirts on. They congratulate Gato. They hand out 5,000 trophies, I think it was, for each suicide dive that was delivered. And then they have the group photo, and then backstage, another group photo with beer.
With beer, yeah.
So, overall, I mean, a very strong card. What would you guys say, in contrast to the 94 show, what were your thoughts, WH?
Not as strong overall as the previous years, but like a lot of really good matches on this still.
Yeah,
a really fun show. Well worth going out of your way to acquire or see. If someone asked me, what is the epitome of Jushin Liger? What should I see? I say just watch the 95 J Cup. You'll see him in three amazing matches with three different, totally different dudes, like Nanawa with Ultimo Dragon and then with Gato. Like totally different matches, three amazing performances by Liger. He's the Sasuke of this tournament. He had the three best
matches. That's a really good comparison. I really enjoyed Otani in this tournament and the two matches he was in. I'm just always a fan of Otani because he was just such a kind of basic look, black tights, but he was just like, his facials were tremendous and his stuff just always looked so good. And he's someone that I think when a lot of people kind of reminisce about the strong workers of the past, sometimes he does get overlooked for like the Ligers or the Ultimos of the world. And I think he's just a fantastic worker.
He is amazing. He was amazing up until like 2000.
Yeah.
Me personally, I enjoyed the 94 Cup more just because I think I just enjoyed the cast of characters more. And I also, you know, the matchups for me were more appealing than you know, the, I guess, having Gato you know, being so many of these matches on this show. But nonetheless, yeah, another great show.
This is the first Japanese tape I ever purchased.
Oh, wow.
From highspots.com as a high school student, the 95 J Cup. I enjoyed this tournament a lot. You didn't have kind of I think to a degree the Liger comparison is really good, but I thought the 94 show just had such tremendous performances from Sasuke from start to finish. I really enjoyed the contrast here of some of the different styles you had in this tournament, and obviously with Rei Psychosis thrown in there, that was a nice little added bonus for this show. Still a very, very strong tournament, and this would actually be the last J-Cup till 2000, and they did one 2000, 2004, and then 2009, if I'm not mistaken. So they took like these big hiatuses from them, almost like in between. Was there any kind of reasoning?
I think a lot of it had to do with like all the promotions were doing their own thing, but also they, at that point, they also created, like, right after this tournament, they did that tournament to create the J Crown.
Yeah,
so that was like, when we have a tournament, we have like this,
sure,
this junior title that's comprised of eight belts, and we just had a tournament for that. So I think, and things were just kind of like fracturing at that point with like,
yeah, like politically, this is a, it's incredible that this tournament was put together. There's no North American equivalent of like the top offices getting together to put, like, just try and even fathom that in this day and age, and of like Vince McMahon and Dixie Carter are going to get together to put on a great tournament of matches. Like,
well,
it's
who's
just
booking?
It's so Russo. There would be all low blow finishes with the ref distracted. And then Medusa would get into the tournament twice.
Does anybody own the rights to the J-Cup? What's to stop somebody from doing it?
Oh, like right now, like say Dragon Gate want to do a Super J-Cup.
Yeah.
Oh, I don't know who owns the rights to this thing. I imagine New Japan does. That's what I think, because they're the first ones who did it. So, if it gets other promotions to do it, they probably have to say, can we use the name? Okay, right. Sure.
So was this tournament, did this air on television, or was this strictly like a live event and like kind of...
No, I don't think it was aired on television because there's no commentary on this,
I recall. Yeah, that's right.
So like a lot of home releases, like they don't, like if it's broadcast on television, the home release will also include the commentary. There was no commentary on this, so
that's true.
It was good thing too, because then we would miss all that great Chris Jericho. Come on, motherfucker!
Yeah, very true. Well, let's shift over now because we have no shortage of feedback here of questions for WH Park, our in studio guest, who we should update everybody. You are going to be off to Japan in just a couple of weeks.
Yeah, 2 weeks from today, I should be in the air.
All right, we're gonna have to set up some Skype deal here.
We might have to
beam in WH Park because there's a look at this, the demand here for Mr. Park. We'll start off with Sam Kennerly, who wants to ask, who in your opinion, did I give you the feedback?
Yeah, you did.
Okay, Sam Kennerly, who in WH's opinion is the current most underrated Japanese wrestler, and who is his personal favorite of all time, and who you can see being the future of Japanese wrestling? So a bit of a three-part question here, starting with right now, who you think the most underrated Japanese worker is?
Akira Tozawa.
Really?
Yeah.
Interesting. Who people can see now, North America as well, working a lot
Dragon Gate
shows.
This last year has just been amazing. I can't wait for him to go back because hopefully they'll have seen his stuff and the Dragon Gate office will have seen his stuff here and just be like, we pushed this fucking guy to the moon.
Personal favorite of all time.
Personal favorite all from Japan? It's tough. I kind of like flip-flop between like Kenta Kobashi and Jushin Thunder Liger.
Yeah.
I honestly, it's a tie between those two.
Yeah, that's not an easy debate for anybody. And the future of Japanese wrestling.
Future Japanese wrestling? That's hard to say. Like, I saw these questions on the Facebook page, and I was thinking about
Hashimoto.
Daichi Hashimoto? No, I wouldn't say.
I was just amazed by people feel like he's, 16 right now?
Something like that, 16,
like, man,
17.
Way to pin something on this guy. Like, it's just, man, the guy's had 3-4 matches at this point, and he's 16.
The future? Because all the guys in New Japan right now, like, going to be the standard bearers are there already, and I don't see the guys underneath them being at that level where they're going to break through yet. In a couple of years, sure, but no one in New Japan fits that mold of like that these are going to be guys taking over from Tanahashi and Nakamura and Makabe. I don't see anyone in New Japan right now who is going to be like that. Noah, there's a lot of talented guys in Noah, but the problem with Noah is like they have such shitty booking.
Yeah.
It's like it's all like you know, like they, no one goes anywhere. It's all like parody booking. You got guys like Morishima, Sushi Aoki, Kenta, and all these guys who should be stars, but they're not because of like the style of booking in Noah. You still have great matches, but there's no progression in that company, so I can't see anyone in there being the future.
Who is the booker in Noah?
The booker in Noah is, I think it's Marufuji.
Huh.
Yeah.
With input from like Tawe and Ryu Nakata, who's like the owner now. But Marufuji does a lot of the booking in that company.
Not doing a good job.
No.
I think that's a big handicap right now, is that's kind of like a holdover from the mid-90s, where it was kind of positioned as you had this division of wrestlers where on any night someone could beat somebody. Mm-hmm. But that's, you know, it worked for a time period, but at the same time, when you're trying to build new talent, I think that's a major, major handicap when you're just, you know, doing this 50-50 booking with guys.
But to answer the question, there are guys who I think are, like, show a lot of promise, especially like in current All Japan product. There's four guys there that I like have seen recently. I'm just like, these guys, they're gonna be the future of All Japan Pro Wrestling, and hopefully they'll, you know, raise All Japan's profile a bit more. That four guys are Manabu Soya, Seiya Sanada, who just went to the Champions Carnival Final against Yuji Nagata. He had a great match. Hiroshi Yamato and this guy Kai. They're four amazing wrestlers, and they just kind of, I don't want to kind of pin this label on them, but they kind of remind me of like the four guys that were in the 90s, like Kobashi, Misawa, Kawada, and Tawe. They're not the same, but they kind of sort of remind me of that era in a way, and I hope All Japan sees that and kind of pushes him that way. Other than them, I'd say Katsuhiko Nakajima. He's still he's only like 22. He's phenomenal.
It's already been working since what, like 2004?
Since he was 16, yeah.
Jesus.
Next question from William Stewart Young. Can WH talk a bit about the significance of Wrestle Kingdom on the Japanese wrestling industry? I know very little, and it seems to me like the WrestleMania of New Japan.
Oh, the January 4th Tokyo Dome shows?
Kingdom.
It does become Wrestle Kingdom until like 2007. It's actually the first time they did it, they called it Starrcade 1992 in Tokyo.
That's right, they did.
The significance of it, I think it kind of like, not legitimized pro wrestling in Japan because it was already legitimate, but it kind of like showed that it can make a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think it was the first dome show anyone ever did, and it sold out. And then subsequent ones, like especially the ones with like involving the UWFI New Japan feud,
mm-hmm.
and then from there on, like they just drew tremendous houses for those, and then it positioned New Japan to be like, I think if you read the Observer back in the day, you'll see like they were the number one box office in the world for wrestling. They were higher than WCW and WWF in the 90s, and they were maintained that position for a long time. The significance of Wrestle Kingdom, I don't know, like it's like people I don't think most people consider it like a WrestleMania like New Japan does. I think New Japan fans do, but like overall, like they don't like Wrestle Kingdom doesn't really have like kind of the legacy, like especially in the last 10 years of like having like WrestleMania moments or like matches that are WrestleMania caliber. Like you have great matches, but like nothing that I could go out and say, oh, I remember that one from 2006.
I remember that night Jeff Hardy had the greatest match in Tokyo Dome history.
That's right.
Oh, the infamous promo. Do you think it'd be a mistake at this point for them to leave the Tokyo Dome? Because they're not at a point now where they're selling out the Tokyo Dome, but it's kind of it's like a status thing right now for New Japan.
It is. The only reason they still do it is because they don't want to look – they think they would look bad if they don't run the Tokyo Dome because it's their tradition. But, I mean, if it's costing them like a ton of money to run it and they're not making money, I don't see what the point would be of running those shows anymore. I mean, I remember when they would do Tokyo Dome like 4 times a year.
Yeah.
And it was ridiculous. And they thought, oh, we got to do it because we're New Japan. It's like, okay, you're gonna lose your shirt.
It's like
Noah
now with Budokan, where it's just they don't have that main event that's gonna fill that arena.
No, they don't.
It's not worth running. Chad Rivera. Hey guys, I'm looking forward to this review, and we'll try and find a copy of this to watch before the review comes out Monday, as I do every week. Can you tell me more about the downfall of All Japan Pro Wrestling in the early 2000s and the founding of Pro Wrestling Noah? I've heard in different shoot interviews that much of this is due to Motoko Baba taking over the company after Giant Baba's death. Just how disliked was Mrs. Baba, and what was the final straw that led to around 85% of the roster leaving and going with Misawa to Noah? Thank you again.
Well, he pretty much hit it on the head, like, the reason why All Japan like got decimated in the late 90s and 2000s because half the guys left to no 90% of the guys left to form Noah, and it was mainly because like no one liked Mrs. Baba. Like she had dealings with running the office when Baba was still alive, and no one, but they tolerated her because they all loved Baba.
Yeah.
You know, they love Giant Baba, so they would tolerate, okay, Mrs. Baba is doing this and this in the company, okay, whatever. We don't like it, but that's wife, you know, she whatever. But then when he dies and she takes over, she now owns the company, and I think the straw that broke the camel's back was like the direction like Misawa wanted to take All Japan, hypothetically wanted to take it in a certain direction, and Mrs. Baba said, no, I don't want to take it in that direction. And I don't exactly know what that direction would have been, because if you look at Noah's booking, it's pretty much the same as All Japan Pro Wrestling. So I don't know what that necessarily is. But I think it was more of a case of, like, I want to run this company. You don't have a clue how to run a pro wrestling company. But she was like, well, I own it, so fuck you. And then it was like, okay, I'm leaving. I'm going to take all these guys with me. The only two who didn't go were Masanobu Fuchi and Kawada.
Yeah, that was it. And then it was funny because basically a year and a half later, when like Muto, Kojima, and Kendo Kashin came in, it was like Muto was pretty much given like booking control of the whole place at that time.
Yeah.
It was 18 months later, after pretty much your whole roster was decimated because of that, you know, line in the sand that this is my company, I'm going to run it, and pretty much created.
Because Muto knows how to talk to the ladies, Misawa doesn't.
that's the key.
That's the key.
Next one.
Jack Bell. My question is, why wasn't Rey Mysterio versus Psychosis added to the tournament?
I think it was already the set, and then I don't know who you would have taken out of this tournament per se, but then I don't know who Ray would have worked in this tournament.
Dos Caras.
Like, really, like, who's like, I think it was, they're brought over to have like a Lucha Showcase match. That's Ultimo's idea. Like, but if you put Ray in the tournament, who's gonna have a match as good as he would with Psychosis?
Yeah.
At this point, because like Ray doesn't become like a world class worker until after WCW, right? Mm-hmm. Where he can work with anyone. He can only work Lucha style, and most of those guys couldn't keep up with him. And like the reason they have such a good match is because they did the same match for like 5 million times before they even got to Japan. So. Mm-hmm.
Aram Nasrallah. How big was Yoshitatsu in Japan before coming to WWE? Okay, yes, like a million questions here. I'll just read them here and we'll go through them. What do Japanese people think of WWE's current product? Do they like John Cena's promos? Yes, because everyone has one opinion in Japan, by the way. And what did Pride do to pro wrestling back in the early 2000s? Japanese MMA couldn't hurt their product like UFC does to WWE, can they? Okay, so let's start off here. Yoshitatsu in Japan.
Yoshitatsu's original name is Naofumi Yamamoto. Mm-hmm. He was a young lion in New Japan Pro Wrestling. As a young lion, he would lose a lot. But he was pretty over. His T-shirts, every time he came out with a new T-shirt, fucking thing sold out. Like, he's like, he's like the Zack Ryder of New Japan. That's right. But no, like, I think he was going to be positioned to be like a top level guy at some point. But I think he left New Japan to try and get into WWE. He didn't have a contract. Mm-hmm. He took a chance. He moved to America. He went to try to get into WWE.
And was in Florida forever before they finally called him up.
And they finally gave him a developmental, and they finally put him on the main roster. But was he a big star in Japan? No. He was someone like New Japan fans would look at and is like, we're going to cheer him because he's got promise and we like him and we think he's going to be a star later on. But he never reached that level. Though he sold a lot of T-shirts.
That's the key. The overall attitude the Japanese have towards the present WWE product.
I think probably the same that everyone else has of the present WWE product, that it's shit. I think you find in Japan, like, most wrestling fans, Japanese wrestling fans are Japanese wrestling fans, and most Japanese WWE fans are WWE fans.
Yeah.
I'm sure there's crossover, but I tend to find, like, from what I understand, from what I read, that most, like, Japanese WWE fans don't watch anything else but WWE.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, but I think houses are down. I don't think their last tour over there did very well.
And also, what Pride did to the pro wrestling industry back in the early 2000s?
It kind of really hurt it, actually.
I thought it hurt it significantly.
Yeah, I mean, part of it, like a large part of it, was because it got on prime time.
Yep.
National free television. So, and pro wrestling wasn't on that. So, first of all, you got all these guys who are getting more exposure than any pro wrestler. Second, Inoki involvement with Pride, like he just sold out all the guys in New Japan. Like, Nijigata, you're going to fight Mirko Krokop.
That was, to me, that New Year's Eve show 2001, where you put Nagata, your IWGP heavyweight champion, in there with Mirko Krokop, and he was just murdered. It's like, you have no faith in your own product here. It's just like you're sacrificing this for mixed martial arts. And it was just like, you know, that whole mythical, you know, who would win. Nagata at least had this aura about him that was destroyed in that night. I don't think he ever recovered after that to that degree.
Exactly. No, he didn't. He recovered like maybe 5 years later, but only within the pro wrestling circles. Mm-hmm. Because he would just have match after match after match. That was really good. The other thing about Pride and MMA in general is like, okay, now you have like, before pro wrestling was like, kayfabe was, oh, these guys are tough. These guys are like supreme, the martial arts combatants in Japan. Like, you know, everyone I think probably knew it was kind of fake, but they didn't. But they still look at these guys as being super tough. But then you have like MMA, and it's real fighting, and these guys are now the national stars now. Yeah. And it's like, wait a sec, that pro wrestling stuff doesn't look anything like real fighting in MMA. So I think that hurt pro wrestling, like in the eyes of the general public, where they're like, wait, actually that stuff we thought was like super tough isn't as tough as like real fighting, which is, you know, which would be MMA. So I think on those levels, that's Pride really, and MMA in general, really hurt pro wrestling in Japan, which is funny because now MMA is dead in Japan.
Yeah, I mean, both industries are struggling, and, you know, I would say wrestling is better off in Japan than mixed martial arts. I mean,
for sure.
MMA is holding on by a thread there with Dream.
Mike Still, can you explain a bit about the role of comedy promotions like Hustle and acts like Hard Gay and Ibison? It seems strange for an industry that seems based so much on realism to have such a contrasting product.
I don't think it's that strange because I think, you know, Japan is known for its, like, diversity.
Yeah, if you've ever watched some, like, talk shows there, I mean, it seems to be natural for that.
I think so. Like, I think in the 90s, you had this explosion of, like, different styles of wrestling. So before, you just had, like, All Japan, New Japan. So you had, like, Strong Style and Royal Road style wrestling. And then later on in the 90s, like, a lot of indie promotions came along, particularly like FMW. So now you had like hardcore wrestling in Japan. So that caught on. So like I think other promoters thought, oh, we can do different things here. Okay, so we'll do like all like a hybrid of Lucha Libre and Japanese wrestling, like Michinoku Pro and Toyaman. And then things like comedy wrestling came into forefront because of like well, Hustle was like a creation of Dream Stage Entertainment, oddly enough.
It was like their first show or two. It was actually presented like seriously. Like they paid a lot of money to bring over Mick Foley for a match, Bill Goldberg on like the same card. They were using like Mark Kerr, Mark Coleman, and then it kind of just evolved into the comedy promotion. I think a lot with Hard Gay kind of taking off is just this.
Well, Hard Gay was a celebrity on TV before he got into pro. He was a pro wrestling fan, but he was mainly known as like this celebrity that would show up on all the talk shows, and it's like, oh, he's pretending he's gay. Oh, okay, that's kind of funny over there.
Razor Ramon.
And then he got into Hustle and did pro wrestling. But Hustle never made any money.
No,
it was like they couldn't even fill Cora Kid up. So like it was just kind of the thing that Dream Stage would do, and then like, oh, well, you know, it's part of just some entertaining thing, but we'll sell some DVDs from this. I don't think they ever made any money from it though.
Wasn't there an angle where they sprayed mist into Aki Bono and he became pregnant?
No, that was
am I mixing up characters?
This girl named Yintling the Terrorist, and Muda like sprayed the green mist and then she got pregnant and then she gave birth to Aki Bono.
Oh, it gave birth to Aki Bono.
Yeah, that's right. Something like that. Like Vince Russo would have been proud.
That'll be our next review, everybody. Yeah. Hustle. And the birth of Aki Bono. Next up, Steve Kassan. My question is about the streamers they throw into the ring before a big match. I always want to know why or the significance of doing such a thing. I can look it up, but with an expert like WH, I'm sure I will get a thorough lesson. And who would be ranked higher between Jushin Liger or Great Sasuke? So first, the streamers.
The streamers. I mean, why do they do it? To show their appreciation for their favorite wrestler.
There you go.
If you watch, like, particularly like in All Japan, because everyone's color-coded. Like Misawa's green, Kawada's black and yellow, Kobashi's orange. So when they call their name, when they call Kobashi's name, what color of streamers do they throw in? Orange. When they call Misawa's name, it's yellow and silver. It's green and silver, and Kawada, black and yellow. So it's simply, they just... That's my favorite wrestler. I'm going to throw my streamer in for him.
Streamer industry must have just been booming.
Must have been.
Day of a show.
I think it originated in Joshi Pro Wrestling, actually. And then it carried over into men's wrestling in Japan. Because I don't recall too much streamer throwing in like 80s footage that I've seen.
There's that Terry Funk retirement match where I know that was... I just remember that scene from Beyond the Mat with all the streamers. Retirement number one.
Which would have been 83, yeah.
Jesus Christ. All right. Who you would rank higher, Jushin Liger or Great Sasuke?
Oh, Liger. For sure. He had a longer career. He's more influential. Just amazing worker. Much better than, like, Sasuke's kind of a shell of himself these days.
Sasuke never worked St. John's Hall.
No.
Never got to come over to Canada.
But he did apparently did really good karaoke stuff at Chicago.
Have you seen that clip?
Yeah, I've seen it.
It's awesome. It's my life.
Doing Bon Jovi. So
I don't know who the guy was, though, as he's filming. He's like, is this actually happening? It's just awesome.
All right. Scott McCullough, I was hoping to ask WH, where do things like FMW and that hardcore style of wrestling stand in the annals of Japanese wrestling? Is there a market for it still? Or did it have its time much like ECW did?
FMW was incredibly influential. It was like the third biggest company in Japan after all New Japan.
They filled stadium shows.
Kawasaki Baseball Stadium.
Yeah, they did like 30,000 for some shows.
So,
I mean, they were a giant success.
Yeah, they spawned a lot of like hardcore promotions, not necessarily successful ones, but they spawned a lot of like hardcore, and like hardcore wrestling became kind of a staple in Japan, more so than I think in the United States. And then, is there still a market for it? Yeah, I mean, one of the bigger independents in Japan is Big Japan Pro Wrestling, and their staple.
I can't believe Big Japan has lasted as long as they have. When I saw my first Big Japan tape, I was like, this is fucking crazy. Like, I can't even stomach watching some of this.
The light tubes.
Glass and scorpions and friggin' mouse traps.
But they'll sell a Korakuen. Like every month that they run in there, they'll sell that building out, and that holds like 3,000 people. Like, Tokyo fans are pretty hardcore about their Big Japan Pro Wrestling, it seems to me. So there's still a market for it. Mm-hmm. I think one of the things about Big Japan is that they actually do present, like, outside of the hardcore stuff, they actually have some really good workers, and they present good storylines, and they have some, like, that's the home of, like, Daisuke Sakamoto, who's, like, one of the best workers in Japan right now, and they have good shows overall. I don't like hardcore wrestling. In fact, I hate it. Like, mm-hmm. light tubes to it. It's like, why you gotta do that to your body? I don't understand.
We received an email at work this week saying, in case you break any fluorescent light bulb, here are the precautions you need to take to clean up a fluorescent light bulb, because I guess they're like...
This was at work?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah, Laura sent this.
And oh, like, I did get this email.
They're like gases in them and everything, and I'm just like, I see this in, in tapes all the time. They don't follow these precautions. They smash them over their heads, and they're fine.
It's
fluorescent
ridiculous.
Light tubes. Yeah, I don't get it either, but people like it. Next up, we've got Stephen Smith. What does WH think of New Japan's recent tour in the U.S.? And he wishes you good luck in Japan.
Oh, thank you. Thanks very much. What do I think about the recent tour? It's great. I wish I got to see them. I was busy doing something else. But
sounded like some good stuff. Over the, like, I really want to see Tanahashi, Davey Richards. That seemed to be... And
Loki versus Devitt.
Yeah, Loki and Devitt.
Yeah, no, it sounded like it was a successful tour for them. I think it was the way they did it was smart. They didn't try...
Co-pros.
Co-pro with Jersey All Pro, and they didn't try to like, oh, we're gonna let's get into a, like a hockey arena or something. They did small shows with co-promotion with an established North American promoter in the area that they're familiar with, because they just did tri-state area like Philly, Jersey, and New York. They didn't try to go in like Chicago or anything like that. They just stayed in where Jersey All Pro has connections with and can draw their own fan base into these shows. I hope they do more. You know, like, I think Dragon Gate has proven that, you know, you can. With on a certain scale, you can draw a pretty decent audience and probably make some money selling DVDs and maybe internet pay-per-views.
I'm surprised they didn't go the internet pay-per-view route for those shows. There would have been a demand for it, I think.
I think probably because Jersey All Pro does. As far as I know, Jersey All Pro they don't have their own outlet for internet pay-per-views. I think if they did it with like through like you know Gabe or something like that, they probably would have. But he's got his own thing with the Dragon Gate, so I don't think that's going to happen.
I really do think that is the next step for all these indie companies,
just
bypass the Go Fight Live and have your own in-house system. Like, I think Dragon Gate and them, they kind of have their – they have the current template of do it all in-house and eliminate the middleman. And your I mean, Gabe and them have to do something like 200 to 300 buys to break even now. Like, it's a ridiculously low figure, and then the rest is all profit.
I think the future of – you know, just gone a tangent – the future of independent wrestling in North America has to be on demand, and internet pay per view, and getting on like carriers like you know Amazon downloads or like iTunes.
I think the on demand to me is a huge thing because it drove me nuts on WrestleMania weekend. I was out the Friday night and I really wanted to see that ROH show, and I got home and the replay wasn't available for something like 48 hours or something, and it's like, man, if you have to be live, and if you're not live, you have to be available. Like almost instantaneously, because it's just like there's such a short window of time to grab somebody. Like once an event is over, it's really hard to get people after the fact. You know what I mean?
In many ways, I think I would prefer an on-demand availability with a service like iTunes that is simple as, you know, like,
I want to see this match. I don't have to buy the whole show.
Exactly.
I just want to buy this whole match.
Exactly.
Yeah, if I buy the whole show, then I get a bonus match or something like that.
Yeah, like a la carte matches, that's not the worst idea, because a lot of people – a four-hour show, you're really narrow casting, I think. There's only X amount of people that are going to sit in front of their computer for 4 hours.
Yeah.
So.
And it makes it accessible to devices like an iPad, like an iPhone as well. Joey Howell, he wants to ask about the impact of Pride.
We kind of
already
that.
Had. Let's go to Dennis Amaya. Have you ever gone to a Japanese show live, and are you hoping to go while you live in Japan? Also, is your name a play on L.A. Park's name?
Let me answer that one first. No. John, you've known me a long time. I think I was WH way before there was an even
You were, I was going to say, I mean, I met you years before L.A. Park had his legal issues with AAA.
So there you go. The answer's that.
You've been to tons of shows.
Have I been? Yeah, I've been to at least 10 live shows.
That's
Japan.
It?
Well, you know, I was working there too. So
I guess. So can't go to all these shows.
I saw like about 5 Osaka Pro shows back in the day, back in the 2000s. I've seen a Noah show. I saw actually the first ever meeting between Shinya Hashimoto and Misawa in Osaka in a tag match. It's an okay card. I think I wrote a review for The Observer and the live audio wrestling website back in the day. You can check that out in the archives in the Ethernet. I've seen 2 Dragon Gate shows, one in Kobe, one in Korakuen Hall.
Oh, wow.
That was an amazing show. I've seen All Japan in Korakuen Hall. It's a fun little, it's kind of a spot show. I've seen New Japan 3 times in Osaka. The last time I saw them in Osaka was when Muto won the IWGP belt from Nakamura, which is a hot show. Let me tell you something about New Japan fans. Like New Japan fans are pretty loyal, but New Japan fans in Osaka are like crazy. They're like Philadelphia fans.
Oh,
like,
really?
Yeah, like. That's the equipment I can make. They're like Philadelphia fans. They love New Japan and Osaka.
What are some of the venues maybe you haven't gone to in Japan that you're kind of on your bucket list of shows to see at in a particular
Budokan
venue?
Budokan would be the number one. But you know what for me was like Korakuen. I've been to Korakuen. I can die a happy wrestling fan because I've seen my only bucket list would be to see every major company in Korakuen. I've seen All Japan. I've seen Dragon Gate. So now I want to see a Noah show and All Japan show in Korakuen. I don't necessarily have to see a big Japan show.
Have any of these venues been like a ECW arena or Sportatorium moment where you get there and you're like, this is the fucking venue I've heard about all these years? Like, that's what I always imagine going to Japan and going into one of these and thinking, man, this is the famed Sumo Hall or something. And it's
No.
Or are they nice venues?
They're nice venues.
Yeah?
Yeah, Japanese venues are pretty nice. Wait, you've been to Korakuen?
I have, yeah. On my trip, I walked in there. It was open, so it looked to me like a big gymnasium, to be honest, just because you know, the colors and the wood and everything. It was empty, so I have never seen a show there, so I can't really say.
Yeah, if you're a fan of Japanese wrestling, if you have a goal, you don't have to see a show in Budokan. You don't have to show at Tokyo Dome. You have to see a show at Korakuen Hall. That is the best wrestling arena in the world.
Yeah, I'm always a fan of the smaller venues where it's like...
It's a perfect venue, for television and for like big companies, small companies. Everyone runs there because it's such a great venue. It looks amazing, and the fan, you can fill it up easily, and the fans are rabid, and it's an amazing building to just visually to look at when you watch wrestling. Probably the best place I've ever seen wrestling live in my life. Not that I've been like too many places, but that's highlight. And you know, you come over and we'll go to Korakuen, John.
That's I want to get there at some point. And if all is great, I would love to swing it through work, so I don't have to pay a penny to go.
We'll do the G1 Climax Tour tournament at Korakuen. We'll
there you go.
3 nights there, and we'll go out for drinks afterwards
for some Sapporo.
Sapporo, and we'll hang out with Prince Devitt or something like that.
Taylor Jacobs, how is kayfabe preserved in Japan? Are they as open about the business as they are in North America? And if so, what time did they kind of drop it, somewhat like the U.S. was around 97?
I think, like, a lot of companies, you know, they don't like do the nudge, wink, wink bullshit like TNA does. Or
you don't do backstage vignettes where Tanahashi is telling Nakamura, I'm not following the script tonight.
Yeah, you don't do any of that bullshit. You don't, and like even like kind of the silliness of like
the network executive
of like WWE. Even like they still present as real, you know, what most of the companies do. They still present as real. I mean, I think most fans know it's a work.
You don't have to get hit over the head with it.
No, but like most fans go there to watch. It's an escapism.
It's a thing.
Like, I'm just gonna get into the athleticism and the storylines, and that's all you need to do. Yeah. Like, that's all I ask from from wrestling company. Just present me athleticism and a good storyline, and don't like insult my.
Just show you care. Like, I always liken it back to the fact that I don't need to be reminded during a horror movie that I'm not watching a documentary. I know the context of what I'm watching this in, and I'm into this movie without the lead character stopping midway through to tell me that this is all bullshit. Mm-hmm. It's like, why should I remain here for the next 90 minutes, you know? Like, the fans are there, and therefore, there's a reason they got there to watch your product to begin with. And that's, I don't want to make this a TNA tangent. I do that enough.
I have a side question. Is there much emphasis put on promo work in Japan?
Not in what North American fans would think of traditional promo work. Mm-hmm. They do promo work in the sense, like, they'll treat it like a real sport and like, okay, I'm going to cut a promo, but I'm going to cut it in the back with all these reporters interviewing me.
Right.
And then they'll cut promos. They only, like, they do promos in ring and they'll call out people, but that's not as common, like, not what we would think. Mm-hmm. Like, you're not going to see any, like, wink-wink, nudge-nudge bullshit John Cena does, mm-hmm. like, where you can't take the guy seriously because he doesn't take anything seriously, so why would I take the product seriously? If any place, I guess the most mainstream place that would do traditional promo work would probably be Dragon Gate. Mm-hmm. Like, they're kind of known for getting on the mic and mm-hmm. just cutting promos on, like, to build up storylines and stuff like that. And I think they get a lot of that from the influence of, like, Onita. Onita was, like, one of the first guys to, like, be really good at, like, just cutting promos mm-hmm. and getting over on promos alone. Because it sure as shit wasn't on his work, let me tell you that.
Or his taste and storyline ideas with Puerto Ricans.
We have our next question from Mike Richards. This is along the lines of what Mike Still asked earlier. Mick Richards, I'm sorry. Can you talk a bit about the Hustle promotion? For what little I've seen, it appeared to take sports entertainment to the level of almost parody. How did this style go over in Japan, and were the careers of the wrestlers who appeared on the shows negatively affected?
I think we answered the first part. Like, it didn't make any money, so, you know, it wasn't really influential.
How about a guy like Kawada, who was attached to that company significantly? Did that kind of affect his appeal?
Nah, because, you know what? Kawada fans we're going to go watch Hustle. So they never saw him in Hustle, which would be a shame because then they wouldn't have seen him singing, which he's quite an amazing singer, actually. But no, like, you know what? Kudos to the guys who got hired by Dream Stage to work Hustle and, like, you know, like mostly the 01 dudes. Because, shit, they got a paycheck out of it. Not like they were making any money in 01. So it's like, hey, Dream Stage Entertainment, we're going to throw you money. Just work our Hustle promotion. All right, I don't give a shit. You give me money? All right. It's money on the table. It's food on the table. Roof over my head. Sure, okay. I didn't negatively plaque because, like, no one who was a serious wrestling fan was going to watch. Like, you wouldn't care if Otani was being a goofball in Hustle.
Out of my way to watch that. What do you mean? I don't know if I'd watch a whole show, but...
I don't think it negatively affected anyone, like, because people still have careers there, so.
And we'll finish off with Kazuki Miura, who says, this is Kazuki from Japan. I've been watching Japanese wrestling for 12 years. Wrestling was hot in here in the 80s and early 90s, but now is getting worse every year. What do you think about the future of Japanese pro wrestling?
I don't think it's getting worse every year myself, like, but that's me as an outsider. But I think it was getting pretty bad. And then now it's leveled off. I think there's a stability to Japanese pro wrestling right now, like in terms of like how much money they draw, in terms of arenas and doing tours and their television deals that they have. What I think about the future of Japanese wrestling really has to depend on the future of like media presented in Japan. Like,
how many offices have television right now?
They all have television of some form, but not many of them have national television.
Yeah.
Not many of them are on network television.
So a lot of them are kind of on
cable.
Small cable.
Right? They're on cable. And the thing about that's different over there is that cable's common here. Everyone pretty much has cable here.
So
if I had cable, I can watch I could have watched ROH back in the day. I can watch not that I would, TNA on Spike TV.
Impact Wrestling.
And there you go. Or WWE on USA Network if I had cable, right? Uh-huh. But over there, cable's more expensive. It's not very common. So unless you're on free network TV that everyone can get, like, your exposure to the general masses is very low. And that's what you need to be popular and to draw money, to draw people to come to your shows.
And introduce your next wave of talent, get over to a mass degree. Like, it seems like the television right now, it's just servicing the diehard fans that are going to remain with us no matter what.
Yeah, and then, like, I think, you know, one of the, like, so a lot of the indies go on Samurai or on Samurai Television, which is a premium cable channel. Like, if I had cable, I wouldn't have Samurai because it would be too much for me.
Oh, really?
And it wouldn't be worth it to me just to watch some of the stuff that they have on there. I would probably get a base cable package and I would order the Garo channel, which is where All Japan, Dragon Gate, I think Kaitai Dojo shows are on Gaara. That's the only channel I would. That's the only channel I would need because like the best television show is Dragon Gate.
Yeah.
You know. So, what's the future? I don't know. Like really, they have to get. They have to. There has to be like kind of like this zeitgeist almost of like people wanting to get back into pro wrestling and like watching it and being fans of it again. And some network executives that say, "Shit, I miss pro wrestling on national television on our network. Let's get pro wrestling back on our network. Mm-hmm. Let's try it out as an experiment. If it takes off, it takes off. If it doesn't, it doesn't. But if it takes off, then there's a groundswell. It's like other networks are like, oh shit, let's make a deal with one of the other pro wrestling promotions because so-and-so promotion network is doing really well with this company. We should do it with one of their rivals and stuff like that. That's what I think needs to improve the business over there. I don't see that happening anytime soon, but that's what I think needs to be done. Or there has to be a groundswell of like, you know, what's happening here with indie promotions needs to happen over there with like people like Japanese companies getting on like on demand and on the internet and like video download being able to, you know, video on demand and, you know, internet pay-per-views and stuff like that as well.
Anything else, Mr. Ting?
No, that's
all our questions. So big thank you, WH. The next time we chat with you, you're going to be all the way in Japan, where you are going to be moving in just a couple of weeks. So a big thank you, as well to everybody who left your questions in here. You can, of course, always leave feedback at reviewaway.com or facebook.com/reviewaway. And that is going to wrap things up for this week. A big thank you once again to WH Park for reviewing the Super Jacob 95 and answering all these questions here from people. And before we get out of here, Wei, next week, Do you have a pick?
I do have a pick this week.
What are we going to do?
A lot of people have been requesting this show ever since we started the Facebook group, and it is not a wrestling show. We've been doing too many of those lately, I think. So I would like to review the episode of Louis Theroux's Weird Weekends, where he travels and visits a WCW show.
Oh, people have been hounding us to review this for like a year. All right, so we'll take a look at that for next week. And, of course, we'll be back on Tuesday with a review of Raw and also chatting about Tough Enough. And don't forget, if you're listening to this on Monday morning, Tough Enough debuts in Canada tonight, 7 Eastern on Fight Network. Back-to-back episodes. It's episode 1 and 2, and then you can check out Raw. So thanks for everyone for joining. And, WH, what are we going out with here song-wise?
We're going out with Jushin Liger's entrance theme. Yes. It's an amazing song.
Fantastic.
Yeah.